Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the Random Crap Podcast. I'm your host, Lee Sands, a.k.a. Rather Odd Ranger, and tonight I have two special guests.
Okay, which one goes first? Sorry.
Anyone then.
All right. Well, hi there. My name's Martin Hitherchuk, and I'm a colleague of sorts of David Ault, and I've known him for many years. And through him, basically, I've got in touch with Lee and been in touch for a few days leading up to tonight, and just going to try and do the best I can for this podcast.
Okay. Thank you, Martin. And my other special guest is...
Hello, I'm David Nagel. I'm a fan audio film producer. I run Dam Productions, or Dam Audios, or Dam Films as we used to be called, which is damproductions.org now. I'm here because Lee asked me very nicely, and I thought it was about time that I did something that wasn't an audio, playing the Doctor, or anything like that. I'm also responsible for the Doctor Who fan film database, so please visit that one as well. Yeah, so I'm just here to give some random, completely random comments off the top of my head while I'm sweltering.
That's one of my icebreaker questions. How are you fine chaps coping with this heat wave over the UK at the minute?
Well, I'm finding it a real pain to try to go to sleep at the moment. Normally I switch off okay, still having a million things to do, but with this heat, you know, even at night time it's in the teens, and not great for that.
I've got a towel, a dry towel over my bed, because I'm sweating like mad, and basically I ain't fall asleep once I sort of get exhausted, essentially. You know, I'll just lay down, wait for to turn off, you know? It's the only way you can really do it, but then... problem is I'm waking up early because the heat's waking me up.
Yeah. It's come out all of a sudden, and I don't know. It'd be nice to have a proper ventilation system, but I don't have that. So, what can you do?
I live in a loft, so all the heat rises up to me.
Ah, oh, I see.
How are you coping, David?
Sorry, was that? I occasionally get your dialogue cut out there.
Oh, sorry. I was about to say, how are you coping with the heat?
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry. I'm sure you do lots of editing later with...
I'll try.
Yeah. Coping all right with the weather this end. I'm in a fairly oldish building, which probably 1600 something odd building, so I don't suffer the heat that much, but I am sweltering today. At night it's okay. Unfortunately, I don't have a towel nearby to dry my brow, but I have been walking around with a towel since the 23rd of May to celebrate Hitchhiker's Douglas Adams, celebrate Douglas Adams Day sort of thing.
I forgot about that because of... working. I've been doing 5 days, 12 till 8 all week.
Okay.
I just found an excuse to go to work with a towel.
Maybe there'd be more peace in the world if we all just walked around for a towel. It's a random thought.
Yeah. Not bad one day.
So, before we get into the meat of the topic, because I just want to quickly explain to our listeners what started this off, because originally me and David were going to tackle this topic after I saw a video podcast review of what was it, Twin Dilemma, that was it, some American chap named Nass over from another website called That Guy with the Glasses did a very nasty review of Twin Dilemma. Have you ever seen Family Guy, Martin?
Quite a few episodes, yeah.
Are you aware of the character Herbert, the old man that's always after Chris?
Not off the top of my head. I don't think I'd have seen him in more than one or two episodes.
I was going to say, there's an old man in the show called Herbert who he's always around in his dressing gown, he's always got a Zimmer frame, and you kind of suspect that he might be a pedophile.
Oh, right.
So when the scenes in Twin Dilemma... like when the elderly chap adopts the two little kids, they sort of just add in Herbert's lines. I thought that was a bit nasty.
Yeah.
So I did laugh, and then I felt very guilty.
I find it really funny how the guy who plays that old man, he's one of the best actors perhaps they could have got for any Doctor Who, and then he has to act against the twins who are just so bad. Really would.
To be fair, though, I'd rather watch those twins act than watch Jedward.
Yeah, that's quite right. Yeah. Jedward's on a whole different level of crazy.
We'll do a mixed version of Twin Dilemma with Jedward instead. As the two twins.
You think that's what the Power of the Daleks blokes to do next? Reconstruct Twin Dilemma with Jedward?
Yes, that could work as well.
Ooh.
Do you know they were on last night with that Eurovision business?
I literally went on Facebook and all I saw was people swearing about it. It was just like people saying, why did I bother putting on the telly? Why did I bother watching this site? Please God, let it be over soon. Just a long stream of profanity from various friends. I even refreshed the page twice and it was still freaking, you know, people moaning and swearing about it.
Yeah. No. It's kind of cruel that Humperdinck did so badly in the final tally. Mm. I mean, he should have been given some credit. He was the oldest guy ever in the competition. But never mind.
Definitely better than the last few acts we've had over the years.
Yeah.
I mean, does anyone remember that really weird act where they all dressed like flight attendants?
I might have missed that, yeah.
Hmm?
Scooch, I think it was called.
Oh, God, yeah, that was their name. They had a silly name. I remember they were on SNTV Live, and I just thought, oh, this is terrible. The next day I found out they were on Eurovision, and I was like, this is not a world I want to watch TV in.
All right, I've actually had a little Google, and I do remember it now, and it was absolutely dire.
That's an episode of Nathan the Matt Smith Doctor. He goes to Eurovision to try and get rid of the worst sacks, like, just rig it, say, okay, I'm going to explain something to you. Hang on. Right, Amy, right, you have to understand, if Scoochie win Eurovision, it will cause World War III, so I have to change history. But Doctor, how does that work? How do they cause War III? Don't question me, Amy, tie me, Amy, and all that.
Yeah.
Funny enough,
I said I can see that happening.
Yeah.
And Abe replaces one of the Scooch members ever so briefly.
Funny enough, I just seen Benedict Cumberbatch and Matt Smith host. I think they're presenting Stephen Moffat with award on the BAFTAs just now.
Uh huh.
Because that's on at the minute. Like I said earlier, but. Thank you. We'll quickly get into production, folks. So, for tonight's episode, we, after, like I said, saw that review of Twin Dilemma and thought it was a bit harsh. I suggested, David, how about reviewing Attack of the Cybermen, the first episode of season... I had it then. Blooming heck, sorry. Season 22, yes, thank you. So, yes.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I've got Wikipedia up, says first episode of series 22. So I remember Twin Dilemma was the last episode of that season, and then you had to wait like a year for next year's season because it's how John Nathan Turner worked back then. But we'll touch on that in a minute as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But I chose Tackle Cybermen because, one, that guy hadn't done it yet. And two, it's one of those stories where it literally divides fans down the middle. Some hate it, some love it, and then there's others that just tolerate it, which is a bit weird. Heck, I've met fans that refuse to believe that the show carried on after Davison left. But then again, you're always going to get fans like that, aren't you?
Well, yeah, and perhaps even more with Tom Baker leaving, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember meeting this hardcore guy, still effusive belief, Seth McCoy, who's ever the Doctor. Oh, no, that never happened. I was like, what do you mean, never happened? I'm holding the DVD, writing, la, 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 like, spit his ears on it, hands on his ears, and just went, la, 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 never happened.
Yeah.
Fair enough, Seth McCoy had a somewhat rapey first season, but come on, Curse of Fenric. Silver Nemesis.
Probably one of the best.
I've still got a fondness for Silver Nemesis. But yeah, have you both watched the movie edit of Curse of Fenric?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
David?
I'm nodding, but you can't see
me,
yes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that is a very good. It's brilliant, you know. You still got people who hung on to that footage they saw so they could. So I remember watching the documentary and you had one of the chaps mentioning, oh, I just kept everything and then rang up. I was like, well, I've got all this stuff we never use. Do you want it? But no, Curse of Fenric is definitely quite possibly one of the best darker episodes of Doctor Who in years.
Yeah. And Nicholas Parsons was amazing, given that he was known for light entertainment. He really convinced you about his character's strengths and weaknesses.
Mm.
Really, really brilliant performance. Shame he didn't make it into the last episode, but still, he left an impact.
I think that's what I like about the Seth McCoy era. So it's a mixture of things. I mean, you have them trying different things, like, you know, Battlefield. I love Battlefield. I know people hate it, but I absolutely love Battlefield. Because after I watched it, I then watched the making of with my uncle, and you can tell that was a favourite amongst the production team, because everyone behind us, they interviewed everyone who worked on it, and they all had all these positive comments. And it's just one of those episodes I think, yeah, you clearly enjoyed yourself. That's good. It's good because it shows.
Plus,
what I was just saying, you're going to get friggin' knights from outer space beating the crap out of each other with giant swords, Highlander style.
Yeah, I mostly agree with you, Lee. It's a bit underrated, but that first episode was easily the weakest because the tone just was ever slightly off, and some of the effects didn't work for me, even with their budget.
Mm.
It just seemed a little bit sort of pantomime-y at times, but once you got Jean Marsh in and everything, and then the Destroyer, it really picked up steam.
She's awesome in that. It's really terrifying, in my opinion. A real baddie, you know.
Yeah.
So like they said, she killed that unit officer, but then she like saw someone's side. You know, that's a real villain, and that was something my uncle kept going on about. You don't get that in New Who at all. You don't get real baddies. You just get these Bond pure evil baddies now.
Yeah, that's quite right.
You don't get like a conflicted baddie. Sorry.
I'd much prefer Jean Marsh's Mumbi in Return to Oz.
Oh, I need to rewatch that film. I remember seeing Return to Oz. I don't remember Jean Marsh. She was the woman that kept changing the head, right?
Yeah,
right. I remember now. Yeah,
that's a really scary concept all on its own, never mind a strong acting.
I remember watching that as a kid. I was like, why is that lady changing the red? Like a toy? My mum was like, I'm not too sure. I'm still trying to figure out why they made a sequel to Wizard of Oz after X amount of years.
Well, there were quite a few Wizard of Oz books, and I suppose someone thought they could make a franchise. You know, it would be as popular in the 80s as it was before. You know, just someone wanting to try and get a cash cow of sorts.
You think that would be picked up by a movie company now, really, considering how much money Harry Potter's made?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd rather go and watch Wizard of Oz remake than any of the Twilight films.
Yeah, I've unfortunately seen at least two Twilight films that are equally as forgettable as each other. Just, you know, very, very iffy acting, and there's no pace to them. It just feels like you could just be seeing one scene after another in any order, the way it's all structured. I just find it very unfulfilling, you know. I'd rather watch something that's actually awful, but at least has a bit of energy to it. Twilight's just mediocre and, you know, vacuous.
I think it's why I like Mystery Science Theatre. They're watching awful films, but they're taking the piss out of them at the same time. So
there
is some entertainment value.
Definitely, yeah.
But anyway, folks, yes, so we're going to review Attack of the Cybermen. And for my next icebreaker question is, what is your ideal TARDIS control room?
Shall I go first again?
Why not?
Sure, thank you. Well, I actually think the Russell T. Davis Doctors 9 and 10 TARDIS control is very good indeed. But perhaps the best one from the classic series would be the one introduced from the Five Doctors on, all the way until the end of the run of Sylvester McCoy. I just love the look of that console, really. Big console, and the TARDIS set looked, you know, just right. You know, well lit, just right. So, a tie between those two, if I can say that.
That's fair enough. David?
Good question. I have varying opinions about the TARDIS consoles. I think that I quite like the Eccleston Tennant console room, mostly. I'm not the biggest fan of brilliant. It's, they've left what's his face? I've forgotten his name now. Edward something or other. Just have a, no, the designer bloke, I've forgotten his name. They've just have a day out and just a random spaz of designing some room based on the Torchwood set, and yeah, it didn't work for me. I much prefer the Eccleston Tennant console. It sort of worked mostly, but I mean, compared to what they had in the classic series, while I like the 80s Five Doctors onwards console, it looked very microcomputer, all the same colour, sort of a bit boringness, but I suppose that's how they like it. The early Tom Baker console that Peter Davison acquired, that obviously looked a bit shabby over time, to the point where it starts falling apart. I think, if anything, the layout-wise on the console, the later Pertwee, the Three Doctors sort of onwards console sort of worked best in that regard. But if you're looking at scope and size of the general room, I think the very first console seems to work in that sort of regard, where you've had the whole hexagon circular ceiling piece was most prominent then. And it'd be nice to see, well, not nice to see it again, but I think in that regard, where you have a fully surround, yes, the new consoles do it, but where you have a fully surround three-wall set is quite nice. So that'd probably be my favourite one.
I was going to say, I didn't realise they'd reused the hub set for Matt Smith's console room.
Yeah, that's news to me as well.
Oh, right, okay. If you Google it, you'll find bits and pieces where, obviously, Torchwood was wrapping up, where they were stripping, well, they were moving to America to produce it. They just rebuilt the Matt Smith console set on top of that one.
Right. I can sort of see it now, because he's got that stairs as well, and I can see it in my head, yeah. I can see what you mean now, it does make sense. Okay, my turn now, I guess. sorry. The two console rooms that always stick out, well, three actually, sorry, that stick out in my mind. The TV movie one, just because of how freaking gigantic it is. I always quite liked that one as a child. I thought, it's, you know, he had all those different connections. You know, he had like a little study area with his chair and his gramophone and his library. And then you got the TARDIS slot that's right next to it. And on the DVD, I don't know if anyone's seen this, they actually, before, during filming, someone went round with a camera just looking at the set in different angles. And you saw these little bits like hats with little signs under them, like property Napoleon Bonaparte, property of Winston Churchill, stuff like that hanging on his wall.
Yeah, I recall that tour with Philip Siegel on the...
Oh, that was who it was.
On the D.
Yeah, I do like that room, though. I wish we could have seen more of it. The other two I like is Tom Baker's weird Victorian wooden TARDIS room. That just struck me as odd to look at. You know, I'm not saying I hate it. I'm just saying it's like it's a weird TARDIS console room, and I think it kind of suits the Tom Baker Doctor a bit.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
I don't know, it just screams Sherlock Holmes for some reason, this console room. I don't know. And that sounds weird, but it's just...
Well, he all but dressed up as Sherlock Holmes in Talons.
Oh, yeah, and he did.
End of that series with the console room you just mentioned.
I was going to say, he also played Sherlock as a TV miniseries.
Yes, he did, yeah.
And the other one I like is the proposed Season 27 console room that we ain't seen the model form. I like how futuristic that one looks, and the fact that the pillar is holding up the TARDIS as well. Sorry, the console itself.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite different compared to what we did have at the time.
I think there was quite a craze since that one was seen. I think they obviously it influenced the consoles since. Mm. Where the central column goes up to the ceiling sort of thing.
Mm.
But that console specifically, I think, influenced, showing my sort of roots and what I do, is there's quite a few fan films that sort of did the same thing.
Mm.
One specifically used more or less that exact console arrangement. I can't name it right now. It's completely lost, and I don't know if I've got a copy of it anyway. But no, they do that. They use the...
It's not Time and Again, is it, or...?
No, that's just a hub, sort of smallish one. No, there's a slightly older one than that that sort of dates back. It looks a bit crap now, but where it must have been a model, because you never see anybody go around it. They're all one half of the screen, and it's the other side of the screen.
I get you. I get you now. Okay, then, right. Alright, we'll move on to Tactical Cybermen then. Alright, so basically, I'll just read the synopsis. Doctor Who, starring Colin Baker, Attack of the Cybermen, by Paula Moore, and we'll get into that as well, if that's alright.
Certainly is.
The TARDIS is lured to Earth, London, 1985, by an alien distress signal. Investigating, the Doctor and Perry stumble upon an attempted bank robbery staged through the London sewers by a familiar foe, ex-Dalek agent Lytton. But who is he working for this time? Question mark. For they discover there is something far nastier lurking in the sewers. Cybermen! Why do the Silver Giants need a time machine? What is their devastating plan of attack? And what does it have to do with a catastrophic event that happened long ago in the Doctor's past? Question mark. Okay, well, let's get into this episode then. So, one of the things I do like, this episode starts off with something I love seeing the Doctor do, tinkering the TARDIS. Hello?
Yeah. He plays from wall to wall when they walk into the workshop at some point to go through another roundel. It's quite interesting to see bits and pieces of the various console walls. I mean, in it's quite interesting. I look at old Doctor Who's in a very technical way, in terms of how, you know, what bits of set were used and bits and pieces like that. So it's quite interesting to see that, in that first scene in the TARDIS where he's on the right hand side of the screen and on the right hand side of the wall, and then moves over to the far back wall, sort of to the left. To that roundel. In the middle, you've got this weird TARDIS wall, TARDIS corridor wall with very purposely yellow painted roundels, and I think those are the ones they used when the whole roundel's got to come off the wall rather than just being a hole. They use that wall. But then again, that's not necessarily relevant, but no, I think it's interesting and quite pleasing to see more of the TARDIS in that regard, because you didn't really see much TARDIS around it except wardrobe in Twin Dilemma.
Yeah.
It's good to see, even though there's not much to it, the Doctor's workshop, if you like.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Castlevania, what we really saw in that was just various different rooms, different corridors, and then the Zero Chamber. They just looked like the same corridor over and over again, though, from different angles.
Yeah, pretty much. They had to kind of do tricks to make it look different, but you can tell, especially in the DVD age, you can look at this from all the different angles, yeah.
But, you know, it is nice to... Oops, sorry.
As I said, the most interesting bit of the opening TARDIS scenes is obviously for the dads, is the Perry's...
yeah. You kind of feel bad for Nicola Byrne. She's just, you know, eye candy in these, really. Sometimes, I mean.
Yeah, although, having said that, Lee, her very first appearance where you see the most of her in Planets of Fire, that's in some ways her best show, because there's plenty of character development for her, and she gets to really, you know, show you quite a range of stuff, what's going on with her. Mm. And she's good in Caves of Androzani as well, of course. So, unfortunately, in Con Baker, it goes a bit off that.
Mm. You going to say, David?
I thought Martin was going to say plenty of skin for some reason.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember that in her first appearance, Something Fire. Was she wearing a bikini throughout most of it, or...?
Not most of it, just really the first episode, but that leaves an impression all the same.
So, basically, as the Doctor's fiddling the TARDIS, because this is the thing with the Colin Baker Doctor, he has these, like, moods where he's like, oh, I don't want this, I want this now. And now, all of a sudden, the Doctor wants his chameleon circuit fixed. And you can't help but think that maybe, especially after watching, you know, Doctor's Wife, you can't help but think the TARDIS wants to stay a police box, because it's been very awkward with the chameleon circuit on him throughout this ep.
Yeah, interesting idea.
After watching Doctor's Wife, that's where I got the idea from, because he says he fixed it, and then it becomes a piano, then a pillar. What else did it become?
It was a wardrobe.
A wardrobe.
By the end.
Yeah, and then it's back to the police box, and he's just like, yeah, that's fine, packs it. So basically, as that's going on, we're reintroduced to Litton and, like, his three sort of cronies. So, about to do a bank job. There's Griffiths, played by Brian Glover. Russell, played by Terry Malloy. And, is it Bates as well? Am I thinking of someone else?
No, Stratton and Bates were on the planet Telos only.
So it's Payne I'm thinking of.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Sorry, I keep thinking Payne and Stratton were the two blokes from Telos. Probably just me. We're introduced to them as they're planning to rob this bank by going through the sewers. And then we're also quickly introduced to that the Tame Malloy character, Russell, is, in fact, you know, working undercover. As it's going on, two workmen are killed in the sewers. You don't see... Do we actually see what kills them, or is it just, like, cuts to a point of view sort of them being killed?
I think just the point of view. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you see the effect it has on them, and they scream, and it echoes in the sewers, which is good. Nice and scary.
I do miss that with New Who, the point of view sort of the monster. Seem to rarely get that now. I mean, that was something that... When I rewatched Remembrance of the Daleks a few days ago, there's these awesome point of view shots. In fact, there's also that brilliant one where they're carting the dead body away and you just see the point of view shot of the Dalek, and you got that brilliant music playing that I just love, the Dalek music.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot of fans have slagged off the composer Kev McCulloch, but he was really on form in Remembrance of the Daleks. I like that score from the moment I saw it, yeah, really strong.
Just that strong instrumental piece of the Daleks, so, dun, dun! you know, I guess it's a sign of the times, but this is, you watch some of these 80s episodes and you're like, oh, I miss that. It's not in New Who and I miss that.
Yeah, my problem with New Who is that it's actually too much music, so the impact can be lost at times, you know. If you have a few quiet moments, then the music would be a bit more memorable.
But if you, well, we say that, and then you watch Attack of the Cybermen, and if you watch it from the very beginning, the new series does do the whole JNT, let's play music wall to wall, and if you watch Attack of the Cybermen, you've got music wall to wall. Even in the TARDIS scene, you've got them playing the whole scene up and down with the Perry and the Doctor's dialogue. I mean, he goes a bit angry and talks about his character and stuff. They even put what they then use later on is I don't know if it was in Twin Dilemma, I can't remember right now, where they use bits of the sort of the church organ harpsichord sort of sound.
When he's walking and it goes dan, dan, and then the screen stops and it goes dan.
Very early scenes in episode one, they do use some of the harpsichord sort of harshness against their dialogue. So I suppose really the new series is wall to wall music is just reflecting the 80s wall to wall use of music, which I suppose in a way does play up particular emotions and forces the viewer to decide how they should feel about a particular scene. But you're right in general that it should be quieter sometimes. I mean, it's not until later on where they're in Attack of the Cybermen where they're running around the underground you have less music then, if at all. Davros is talking. What's his face?
Russell.
What's his name? Russell.
Yeah.
He's talking to the Doctor and things. It's not until where you lose music and then it's only played when Cybermen are there.
I was going to say the one you mentioned, the harpsichord music where they're going to dun dun. That's a scene that sticks out. And the other one that sticks out in regards to music is when Russell mentions Lytton. It does that weird sort of tune. I can't quite replicate it in a minute, but it's got that weird tune where it's like a revelation type tune. It sounds a little silly.
I think it's perhaps a direction.
You have to understand, life is so fragile. What we're doing is life. Yes, it can be wonderful, no one else is doing what we're doing. But with that comes danger. And this isn't a fairground ride.
The one thing I've learned since meeting the Doctor is that there is just so much we don't know. Anything's possible.
It's beautiful.
He is a Time Lord. The greatest evil that ever existed.
Oh, everyone knows. But no one says a thing.
The new world doesn't have room for men like you. Only winners like me.
Please be advised that your services are no longer needed.
But it comes down to the same thing. Death and destruction and conquest.
No, it's seen you.
Yes, the Doctor is here.
Get back into the ship.
When you look deeper in your soul, do you see some sort of angel, a hero?
Welcome to hell.
You will be like us.
No! Right, sorry for the break, folks. Anywho, so as we were discussing use of music in this episode, best start talking a bit more because Martin said he's got to go in half an hour.
I can stay a touch longer. It's not the end of the world.
No, I understand. This is. Yeah. I hate to keep people longer than if they've got stuff planned or if they need to go to bed for work. I remember I was on the podcast many moons ago, and basically we're chatting. The hostess kept taking breaks, and then I was like, what was meant to have been like an hour podcast became nearly 4 hours long.
Right.
and then the final product was like nearly 30 minutes. I was like, oh, okay. Are you going to release the 3.5 hours you didn't use now? Oh, fair enough.
Well, you see that in television nowadays. They record the live shows, like for example, Harry Hill TV Burp. You're actually in studio for almost 2 hours, and they're stripping the show down to just 25 minutes most of the time.
That's interesting. So I went to Just a Minute last year, and then recorded two shows back to back, and that was very tight, 30 minutes. You had someone waving at the back to Nicholas Parsons to say, like, wrap it up, wrap it up. But that was a very tight, like, filming, and you mentioned stuff like that. Because I know the Now Show is meant to take nearly 50 minutes long to record, and there's, like, quite a lot of stuff they cut out.
Yeah.
But, okay, folks, just to make a long story short, Doctor meets up with Russell in the sewers after they find the dead, one of the dead bank robbers. Find out Cyberman, yeah, 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 da. They go to Telos, yeah, 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 da. Stop Cyberman, yeah, 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 da. That's pretty much it.
What about the Kryons?
Oh, and they meet the Kryons, yeah, sorry. Yeah. The problem is, I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah.
Because I'd want someone. It'd be nice if someone went to go and watch it after us talking about it.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Because it is a very good episode, in my opinion. Well, it's an enjoyable romp. It's like Tamer always said, it's like two different episodes back to back. Because you've got this nice little, like, crime gangster thing in the first part, and then it becomes pure sci fi in the next one. Like, really hardcore sci-fi.
Yeah, that's just showing how Doctor Who can be so many things at once. The whole scope of the show allows you to have a lot going on, and it somehow makes sense in that context, which is a big reason I like the show so much anyway.
Yeah, that's why I love it as well. I mean, again, back to the Seth MacFarlane era, you could have pure horror episodes like Curse of Fenric, and then you can have pure mad sci-fi episodes like Remembrance and Silver Genesis.
Yep.
Though when I think of horror as well, Ghostlight pops into my head.
Yeah.
That's just creepy, that episode.
Yeah.
I mean, the first part is like that weird Victorian, you know, something weird's going on, and then the second part it's like, oh, it's an alien, cataloging all the different species on Earth, and he's pissed off over evolution.
Yeah.
And then he melts that poor bloke into soup.
Yeah.
I came out of the blue. I remember that as a kid going, oh, I liked him.
Probably why they chose that character, just to have more impact. All very calculated.
The thing I love about that scene is it's Ace's reaction when he realises it's the inspector.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing with Ace in that final Sylvester McCoy season, she really was developed well, and Ghostlight was just as much a showcase for her as for the Doctor, and really was good stuff. But the only problem was a lot of people didn't understand Ghostlight the first time round. It was a very dense show, lots going on.
I think it's like the producers said, the problem with the BBC at the time was, you go to them to make a sci-fi, and you just get endless corridors. You tell me one ice plant, and they just put fake snow on the floor and make everything silvery or see-through, and it doesn't really look nice. But you tell them you're doing something set in Victorian England or period part for Doctor Who, and they're like, oh yeah, we could just raid this wardrobe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I mean, another example of that would probably be Mark the Rani.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask both of you guys is, you know, the Sixth Doctor in Twin Dilemma, he is for the most part not that easy to like, but in his first proper season, he seems to go from story to story, sometimes being quite gentle and sometimes being just as abrasive as before. It's a funny one, really, with him in that season.
I think Terence Dix summed it up best. The problem with the Sixth Doctor is, they're not written the role to Colin Mertz. Like he said, he met Colin, and he said he's a very nice man, totally different to his doctor. And he said after meeting, and Terence Dix said after meeting Colin, he could see ways of making the Sixth Doctor more like Colin, but it had to be a process over, like, say, one or two episodes, and it had to be proper continuity, like the writer would have to remember all these little notes. Sort of thing you could do now, like, say, like, if David Tennant's Doctor had become a pure and absolute arsehole, you could easily do that sort of journey from pure arsehole to the most gentlest man on the planet.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something they could consider if Matt Smith ever leaves. Get Dylan Moreland to be the next Doctor and have him just start off like Bernard from Black Books.
Yeah, I get you. And I think it would be nice if they actually chose a slightly older Doctor, as old as Eccleston was when he joined, if not more, but it doesn't look likely to me. It seems that they want to get a certain fan base who like a young, sort of dashing type, which I think is too restrictive, but what can you do?
Well, I remember Moffat saying a lot of the actors they had come in for the Doctor Who auditions when Tennant left, they had a mixed variety of ages. And in fact, they actually wrote up their guest list for the entire Matt Smith's first year. About 90% of that was based on actors that came in to audition for the Doctor. So, you know, the guy that played the Dream Lord, Bill Nighy, the guy that played Picasso. Not Picasso, sorry, the painter. Was it Picasso?
Van Gogh.
Van Gogh, sorry, yeah, the guy that played Van Gogh. The guy that played the Demon Headmaster, who was in the second episode. You know, they had they just basically said, look, you're good actors, but we can't see you being the Doctor. You won't be in the series anyway.
Yeah, that's a decent policy.
Considering the amount of talent they were getting that year as well.
I always saw the Demon Headmaster being the master sort of person, though.
I think the guy that played the Demon Headmaster would be good if they ever decided to remake an old Dalek serial as the next theatrical film. Because there's a script somewhere for the third Peter Cushing film, and that was basically adapted from The Chase.
Yeah, it certainly needed a better budget than the TV version got. It was too ambitious for just 25-minute, quickly recorded sessions. It's almost laughable, The Chase, but I still kind of like it all the same.
It's the type of thing I'd like to... I think that might work well as a film. You know, you've got this nice variety of monsters in it. I mean, you've got Frankenstein smashing open a Dalek. Yeah. You could easily just rewrite it and say the Doctor landed in a land of fiction.
Well, yeah, exactly.
That would make more sense.
Yeah.
And then Mind Robber all over again.
Yeah, it starts off as The Chase and then it becomes the Mind Robber at the end, yeah.
Oh, I do tend to forget about the Frankenstein House of Horrors bit. I tend to completely forget about those episodes, and I cut mentally from where they were at the Sandpits planet straight to the Mechanoids planet at the end. Mm. I think The Chase works on some levels, but then they go a bit silly, and that's where the House of Horrors sort of bit in the middle comes from. But I think the best bit out of The Chase is the bit where they try and pull a Dalek out of the sand after the sandstorm in the first few episodes. And that's quite interesting, technically, as well as visually.
Do you think Chase would work well as a film, or...?
I mean, it could do, because obviously all films do move around quite a lot, scene to scene to scene. I mean, if you look at Indiana Jones films, you're never in one location for more than 15 minutes. It's always 5 to 10 minutes you're ever in one location, and The Chase works in that regard. And that's, I think that's how The Chase could work as a film. You know, cutting out the House of Horror crap in the middle, my choice of things to do, but it certainly work movie length, because it could potentially get that scale. But then again, you sideline. Alright, we're getting far away from Attack of the Cybermen.
It's alright, it's still Doctor Who. Still technically on topic.
You sideline the Daleks, and they just become a part of the guy, you know, the part of the groups of people getting to the resolution, and the resolution is the mechanoids who ultimately, you know, give the Daleks an excuse to do something for the end of the story, and give everybody else a chance to run off. Mm. I think dramatically the best thing about the chase, as well as the, you know, the jumping from scene to scene to scene, or sorry, scene to scene, from location, 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 is actually the robot Doctor. I mean, that was an unused element, you know, throughout the thing. It was developed very early on. It was quiet until the jungle pieces around the Mechanoid City, and then they had Hartnell fighting his stunt double, or stick fighting, walking stick fighting.
Yeah.
At the end, it was quite poor. They could have used it and tricked more people than how they did it in the end. But obviously, the chase works on the final level. Is obviously it's Barbara and Ian's leaving story as well. And they,
I'd imagine they probably would have to change that bit for the film version, unless their plan was they're going to have the granddaughter leave him.
Right. Possible.
That's the only reason I could see it working, to have that same emotional impact.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. She was quite young, the granddaughter of Cushing, compared to Carol Ann, or whatever her name is.
Carol Ann Ford.
Yeah, thanks.
I think it actually works, having a younger granddaughter. It reminds me of the comic strips, where he had younger grandchildren. I think it actually works for the Cushing Doctor. It makes him seem very gentle.
I agree, but to leave her behind when she's really young, not even looking close to being an adult, if that was the plan, you know, 1966, 67, she still would be just a little kid.
I don't mean he would have left her alone. I mean, she probably would have had to have left him. Like, she would have gone back to Earth because she was tired of travelling with her grandfather and tired of the danger.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's what I sort of meant, because that's, you know, what's happening. Ian Barbara, Nick on the Dalek ships and go back to Earth.
Yeah.
You know, Chase and the Daleks' Master Plan are always two stories I always thought would look fairly alright, you know, as theatrical remakes.
Yeah.
Especially again, it's that location. And Daleks' Master Plan does the same thing.
Yeah.
There's an episode per location. If anything, it's what the chase should have been. It is the chase times 10, effectively, the Daleks Master Plans. So it's just moving everywhere. That's what makes such things, even though it's 10 odd episodes, is it's got the epicness because it's spread across time and space in that regard.
Yeah. Even more tragic, it's now missing, well, good chunk of it.
Three quarters, yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping when they announced they found two more eps, I was kind of hoping, oh god, let it be two eps from Dalek's Master Plan.
Yeah.
No, it weren't, was it? It was Galaxy 4 and...
Underwater Menace.
Yeah. I remember one person saying, oh goody, they found eps 2, a good one and a really shit one.
Well, yeah. But
wasn't Underwater Menace currently getting animated episodes? Or am I thinking Fury of the Deep? Not Fury of the Deep. Something Fury, a William Hartnell adventure.
Right.
They were doing the invasion style thing for it. Give it a DVD release.
Something Terror.
Terror of the Deep?
I can't remember.
Was it? Fury of Terror?
I do not remember.
Well, speaking of Dalek's Master Plan, did either of you two ever see the Say So?
Yes.
Did you see?
Yes, I was there.
Oh.
When was this? Sorry.
2007, I think.
Never even heard about it, but I know that they did a stage show for Davros, I don't know if it was between Destiny of the Daleks and Resurrection of the Daleks, but there was this show with, I think, Terry Malloy himself playing Davros on trial. So I've heard about that.
It's the actor from the Power of the Daleks remake on YouTube at the minute. Did a say-so, the Daleks Master Plan, with the chaps from Devious providing the Daleks and Nicholas Briggs doing the Dalek voice.
Yeah.
And this was sort of like, what was it, 2 years? A year after the show debuted? Like, returned?
Oh, right, okay.
I'm trying to remember. Who
did they get for Mavic Chen, sorry?
I'm not too sure. You have to ask David.
Yeah, okay.
The start of the Davros show was in 2005. In Manchester, the Hippodrome over there, they had Terry Malloy reprised Davros. They brought Peter Miles back as Nida. They had John Leeson as an Inquisitor. They even had Michael Wisher's son. I think it's Michael Wisher. Michael Wisher's his name. I can't remember his son's name, sorry. Who John Leeson regenerates from. So it's Michael Wisher's son to begin with, and then the Dalek shoots him midway through between acts, and John Leeson takes over, I think. Or is it the other way around? I forget. It's been over 6 years. And then in 2006, because they did two, they did Evil of the Daleks first. And it was basically the whole Millennium Trap group. I don't know what they're supposed to be called as a group, but they played the characters amongst themselves in Evil of the Daleks. It's quite good. I attended one of the nights of that one, where the Emperor's behind the fireplace set the entire thing until the end. And then, yeah, it was 2008 that they did Dalek Master Plan. Mavic Chen was one of their balding members of their group. I mean, that was quite interesting. Trying to translate something so epic on stage is to the way of spell actually in the end is scale it all the way back. I mean, it was interesting in terms of how the Daleks were used. If anything, they brought the Daleks on in sets of four at a time for Dalek scenes and have them play out dialogue. It depended a great deal on music as well to set the scene. There was little bits of cut scenes of them green screening themselves into footage, some CGI footage or something, just to transplant or tell you where they are.
That sounds really fascinating, but I'm just wondering how they did the deaths for Katarina and Sarah Kingdom on stage.
That's on YouTube, Sarah Kingdom's death.
Really?
Yeah. Annoyingly, the YouTube video cuts off at the regeneration, though. So they did a regeneration at the end.
Oh, right. So it's not just an epic on its own, it's also the final story for that Doctor in the production.
Yeah. By then, BBC told them to stop doing the stage plays, because obviously they wanted to do lots of new Doctor Who. So they said no, stop doing it. So they made Nick Scovell generate into Nicholas Briggs. Just to play that up. I mean, that was quite funny.
yeah.
And being balding, not ginger, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Oh no, he said at the end, "I'm not ginger." I think.
That's something I'd love to see on the stage, though, the Master Plan. Just adapting it, I mean. It sounds fascinating when people go on about it. So like, last year I went to see Batman Alive, and wow. It's hard to describe that one. It's just so insane.
Which Batman villains were in that?
Quite a host. You had Joker, Two-Face, Riddler, Catwoman, Poison Ivy, Harley Quinn, Scarecrow. It was basically just an adaptation of the Dick Grayson storyline, thrown in with the bad guys take over Arkham plot.
Right, okay.
So first act, Dick Grayson, second act, he becomes Robin to save Batman, who's trapped in Arkham fighting villains.
Right, okay.
it's fun to see. I mean, if it ever comes back to the UK, it's well worth seeing. if I remember correctly, Riddler was played by the guy who was in charge of the Weevil Cage fights in Torchwood.
Oh, right. Don't remember him, but yeah.
He's the one that dies at the end.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that episode. To be honest, I haven't really rewatched any Torchwoods more than the once. Yeah.
Fair enough, but yeah, anywho, so back to Attack of Cybermen, sorry. sorry, folks, but we'll quickly wrap this up. We've got a couple of points. So one of the reasons this is like... I remember when I first started buying the DVDs, I remember thinking to myself, where the heck is Attack of Cybermen? And then I remember reading about there was a problem with it, that authorship... Basically, someone claimed he wrote it, and someone else claimed they wrote it, and that's what kept this sort of like out of the DVD loop for a very long time.
Because originally, that's
new to me. The commentary was recorded back on 26th of June 2007, but the DVD itself wasn't released until 2009.
I didn't know that.
There's a documentary on it, in the Cold War documentary, looks at the making of it. Goes into some detail. Basically, the serial was credited to Paula Moore, who's apparently a friend of Eric Seward. Sayward. But the problem was, he was script editor on the show at the time, and at the time, that was against union rules. But however, an official fan and contingency advisor, Ian Levin, claims he suggested like the plot and elements used throughout it during the conversation with Stewart, and then Stewart then wrote the script and got a friend to say she wrote it, even though he did. But it's very complex, and it's basically, you know, someone saying, oh, I came up with the idea, but you got Ian Stewart saying, well, no, he didn't write anything. He just got me some photos, and that was it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting sort of controversy to an episode that's already controversial, with several scenes like the Doctor... Yeah, Doctor picking up a gun to save Perry, or Letton getting his hands crushed like that.
And what about asking Perry to hold the gun against, I believe, the Terry Malloy character?
Didn't he actually tell her, yeah, just shoot him?
Yeah, well, you know, she looked like, gosh, why are you asking me that?
Well, I think it was just him playing good cop, bad cop, that scene, but
yeah.
I don't know. I can understand the Doctor doing some of the stuff he does. I mean, let's be honest. If Rose had been in danger, like a Cyberman had a hand round her throat, I could see Eccleston's Doctor picking up a gun and blasting the Cyberman. Yeah, I could see the Doctor trying his best... Sorry?
Oh, sorry, I was just agreeing.
Yeah, I could see I can see any of the Doctors doing that. I could see them resorting to violence to save the companion. I mean, for crying out loud, the Seventh Doctor blew up, you know, pretty much tricked Davros into blowing up his own planet. And no one complains about that, but no, Colin Baker picks up a gun and everyone's moaning.
All I can think is simply the context that Colin Baker had that hiatus forced on the show, and he's an easy man to blame, even more than perhaps the producer and script editor. You know, that's all I can think of. You know, it's more than just simply what the Doctor's doing, but how the show's doing as well.
Yeah. It does bother me a bit, people complain about that, but at the same time, like, he is trying to save the Earth from being destroyed.
Yep.
I mean, he stabs on the Cyberman with a sonic lance, which I can understand, you know, they're robots now, they're not real people anymore, they're mindless slaves.
Yeah, I don't know really, I mean, they look just the same as in Earthshock, but Earthshock, there was some sort of dimension to them where they were interested in seeing how humans think, which it almost makes you think that they've got this sort of curiosity which isn't that robotic in a way. But in Attack, there's far less of that, really. They're just sort of deadly killers.
Yeah, the Earthstop feels very like an old-fashioned story where... Sorry, not Earthstop. Attack feels like an old-fashioned Cyberman story, whereas Earthstop, they sort of delve into that whole psychological warfare angle.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is fitting of Earthstop as well, because that's a brilliant episode. I mean, when people ask me, oh, which one of the old series do you recommend me? I always go for, like, Earthstop, Curse of Fenric... Ooh, Genesis of the Daleks. You know, they're the types I list, and I also list the robot because robots are fun.
Yeah, I loved that as a kid, but not one I return to much these days. But certainly a great start, and Tom Baker hit the ground running for sure. He was really born to play the Doctor.
I'm going to admit, I've got the Key to Time DVD box set, but I've not watched all of it yet.
Right.
That's been sitting in my bedroom for like nearly 3 years now.
I'm quite a fan of that sequence of stories.
Apologies, folks. It's just so hot at the minute. I've got a bottle of water that's been in the freezer for 5 hours to keep me cool. That's how bad this heat wave is.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably in the coolest room of the house, if that helps me. You know, if I was stuck somewhere else, it might be tough.
Saying you can't sleep in that room, or...
Well, just anywhere. It's just, at least not yet. It's just not as easy as it used to be. Mm.
Is there anything you want to say about that? Those scenes, David, where, you know, Colin Baker picks up the gun and that, or, you know, stabs someone?
I can understand him attacking Cybermen to some degree, and effectively he finishes the job of the Cyber. I mean, attack of the Cybermen is less what story points there are that are controversial. What I find most controversial is how much you're trying to be a sequel to everything. You're trying to be a sequel to an unearthly child. You're trying to be a sequel to. Resurrection of the Daleks. It's trying to be all these things at the same time, and he just, you know, Ian Levine is obviously just gone, here you go, here's a slab of continuity from absolutely everywhere, why don't you play something that you know, that backs off this.
Yeah, I think it hurts it a lot having, you know, I don't mind the odd like canon nod now and again, but doing one where pretty much it feels like nearly every scene, every major plot revelation goes back to an earlier ep. I mean, I don't mind them bringing back Letton, but I think they could have left out some of the other stuff, like the reference to the original 10th Planet and that. All you have to do is say, you know, what would have made it simpler was, oh, the Cybermen are trying to divert Halley's Comet into Earth so they can try and wipe out most of humanity. That's it. That's simple. That's nice. It's believable, you know?
Yeah.
Not this whole... They got exactly. Time machine.
Sorry, I was just agreeing.
Yeah. You know, it's simple.
I agree too. Yeah.
They could have done that, done without all this complicated, like, canonicity. I'll just be back in one sec. Sorry. I'll just leave the call. Just talk amongst yourselves if you want. Okay, I'll back in one sec.
All right, cool. All right, do you want to pick them up from there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very odd in that regard, playing off so many sequels of everything. You know, the number one rule for, I mean, especially from a fan film, sort of fan audio point of view, it was never right. This is sort of the advice those would give, never write sequels to existing stories, and you know, they're sort of, even television will do their own thing and decide that, no, let's write a sequel to something that wasn't that worthy of writing a sequel for. I mean, you know, the cyber controller, he was electrocuted at the end of Tomb of the Cybermen, and, you know, he's been brought back to do it again, to be shot again. So effectively, you know, and played by the same actor, oddly enough, who's obviously got on a bit of weight since. And
I was going to say, actually, the cover of the DVD avoids you seeing the whole figure of the controller. So that probably was on purpose, because he looks different in that regard.
Yeah. got some age on him. And, you know, the Doctor's more or less finishing it off. If you like, if you want to look at it that way, the Doctor's just finishing what he did originally in Tomb of the Cybermen. Because if anything, he engineered the electrocution of... Well, if you look at it that way entirely, the Doctor's actually engineered the entirety of Tomb of the Cybermen. He assisted everybody in resurrecting them. He did this and this and to get there. And really, it's the Doctor doing it on purpose. Maybe it was a mistake to him, I don't know, but if in a way he was knowing that what was going to happen to some degree. And if you like, he engineered everybody into dealing with the Cybermen or getting killed by the Cybermen or finally killing them. And I've forgotten the bloke's name now. The slave guy, if you like.
Yeah, Toberman.
Who's closing the doors for the final bit, and the cyber controller gets electrocuted.
Think you know who you are? Do you think that in your daily, normal life, you know who you really are? You know, don't you, that the face you've always shown to the world isn't really you? What happens when someone takes the mask off? Oh, you can shut out the fear, the anxiety, and the uncertainty, but if you really want to find out what's going on in the world, you have to come down the rabbit hole. Question is, how far down do you want to go?
Coming February 1st, 2008, from Darker Projects, Doctor Who, Series 3. This year, everything changes.
Right, folks, sorry again for another break. So we're just going to quickly move on to the other controversial scene, Letton's torture scene, which they touched upon in the making of here. Apparently John Nathan Turner wanted it to be more violent.
Mm.
Apparently he wanted the sound of bones breaking and like a little small pool of blood coming from his hands. And you sort of see that. You see the hands literally covered in blood. But you know, I'd love to see that original version they shot. It's quite more darker. His bones being snapped. They're taking the fingers one by one and just breaking them, and more shots of his face being in pain and sweating. And
yeah, fair enough. But I think a whole generation of kids would have been scarred for life. You know, it would be just a little too much for Saturday tea time.
Mm. Just another thing for Mary Whitehouse to moan about.
Oh yeah, good old Mary.
So, moving on. At the end, we find out towards the end. During the event set, we introduced the new aliens, Cryons, which apparently were originally written to be all male, sort of like a sister race to the Ice Warriors. But then the director of this episode suggested, let's make them female. There's too many blokes in this production. And and I think it kind of worked, even though it looks like they got mustaches.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Though I would not be surprised if someone's written a novel about how the Ice Warriors and the Cryons are actually related on some genetic level.
Perhaps, or maybe the Cryons don't need men to reproduce. They're aliens, so you could make that argument.
True.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like someone suggested Ice Warriors are meant to be linked to Silurians and Sea Devils.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
I've heard it somewhere. I'm not too sure where. I think it was one of the novels. It was back just before they reintroduced Silurians. There was like a poll in the magazine saying, oh, which ones do you want back? And someone suggested Silurians, and this guy, this writer in this magazine article said, any problem is the original creator said he wouldn't let them use them unless they redesigned them.
Right.
And they do. They actually look a bit more like Sea Devils to me in the new series, but especially those masks.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think they just want to avoid the rubber suit look and just make it look as much of a real face. But I hated those episodes. They could have done anything with the production, but the scripts, I just... That was the first batch of episodes with Matt Smith where even he couldn't save it for me. But that might be another argument another time, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, at least it wasn't as bad as Daleks in Manhattan.
Well,
that's a whole nother kettle of fish of pure fan raids, but
I'll put it on par.
On par, yeah. we find out that Letton's working for the Cryons to help him, and the Doctor finds out by the time it's too late, he's already started being converted into a Cyberman. Also, we're introduced to two escaped prisoners who run off with Griffiths, named Payne and Stratton, who are trying to escape the planet before it like basically gets destroyed. What's interesting is you see them racing to the ship, and you think they're going to get on the ship at the very last minute, but then no, one of them's killed by a force field, and then they're both gunned, and the two survivors are gunned down by a Cyberman.
Yeah, the last remaining one of Lytton's gang, if I can say that, but yeah. I won't say which one it is. Just to help with the suspense, but yeah, it's all very. Everyone is basically either escaping or gone to the, you know,
yeah,
gone forever. It's a very sort of final climax. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if
not
that
really
thing works.
Sorry, David.
I was saying, and then they didn't really add anything to the story at all.
Yeah, I agree.
Really?
Yeah. They just seem to get killed off at the last minute, and you can understand from the point of view, oh, it seems a bit harsh he killed them off, but at the same time, it's Doctor Who and it's a dark story. You don't always get a happy ending in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the Paul McGann story, Orbis, with the planet he's trying to save. It just ends with him failing and they all die.
Yeah.
But we also like to point out the same Malloy character. He's he meets a nasty end as well, folks. But you know, to be fair,
I think it was used to make Perry's fate look more serious because someone was already offed.
Yeah, quite an unusual way to die: karate chop to the spinal cord, essentially.
Yeah, wonder how that felt when they were shooting it. How many takes they did of it to get it just right.
But now I was kind of hoping he'd survive a bit longer, because he picks up the gun, tries to help the Doctor as well. He's fighting for his life, and then now Cyberman snuck into TARDIS. But you know, you think that will be a plot point pointed out later. I mean, we don't know how long they're in the TARDIS. We don't know if they stole any schematics or they planted something inside it. For all we know, there could still be a Cyberman wandering around. It's like in the PandoraCon episode with that Cyberman, it's just putting itself back together.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Strangely enough, I think that Pandorica was the best Cyberman knew who so far, in a way. Just really creepy.
Yeah. You going to say, David, sorry?
Yeah, I was thinking that, creatures walking around the TARDIS made me think of even earlier than that. If you go back to Invasion of Time, there was another Aaron's still wandering around and never gets eaten by anything, or you know, gets shunted in the swimming pool. But I don't think that's right. I think they all were caught up with. But yeah, interesting to know if there is something still wandering around. But it also makes me wonder, Invasion of Time, why the Doctor has a Sontaran eating plant in the swimming pool.
Makes you wonder, why doesn't the Doctor just have something in his TARDIS for such an emergency? Like, a Cyberman walks into the Matt Smith TARDIS and all of a sudden you hear this alarm bells, and then just a little, it could be anything, like, you just see hear Matt Smith saying, "Hello there, you're a Cyberman, you invaded my TARDIS." Well, not making that mistake again, and then just like a giant sledgehammer appears out of nowhere and smashes it apart. Or just like two logs or something, two metal girders, just like in Return of the Jedi where they get the logs to smash the AT-ATs.
Yeah,
it's absolutely not like something comical yet you could believe's in there. Or trapdoor to a smelting pool.
Yeah. Or he just gets locked in a...
Sorry?
They just push him into a cupboard and lock the door. That's probably what I'd be doing.
But wouldn't the Cyberman be able to just open the door?
Probably. But if you put a bag over its head, he might give up after about 5 minutes.
Fair enough. That is an interesting thought. Why does the Doctor have Santarin eating plants? You think he has it just in that sort of emergency, or...?
I wonder if he's actually capturing it for cooking. Obviously, the Doctor cooking the plants. Mm. I think he's keeping these plants to cook at some point, or use as his salad on a Saturday night, or whatever night salad night to him. Yeah, I think he keeps around for that. Or if it's just, I want a selection of plants around my swimming pool, and then he didn't think about which ones he's actually picked up.
I like to imagine he forgot, and I like to imagine he just picked up like a bouquet of roses, and it sort of evolved into a Santarin eating plant. He just forgot all about it. Oh, I could have sworn that was a bouquet one day. Oh, I really must stop drinking.
Yeah.
It's that sort of wacky thing. I mean, you know, the TARDIS got all these holes in, you know, time energy or whatever it is could have leaked and evolved the plant like it did to make Beep the Meep.
Yes, true. I'm also thinking of that time spillage in another show in season 22, but again, I'll keep it sort of secret from those that don't know, but it's a very interesting use of the time machine having an effect on a certain type of animal. That's all I'm saying. I don't know if you follow me, but I think if you watched the Colin Baker shows back to back from the season, you'd soon find out what I'm on about.
I'll have to go back because I'm missing Vengeance on Varus, Mark of Rani. So I have to go back and re-watch some more, like Marathon on it.
Yeah, yeah.
They're interesting, you know, Vengeance on Varus, for any listeners who are listening, that's currently available on Virgin's On Demand TV service for free viewing. They've added a ton of classic Doctor Who to that. Yeah,
okay. I like Vengeance and Varus a lot, but I think that divides the fandom even more than Attack of the Cybermen in a way. But I don't know how the split is, but there's some who think it's really one of his best and some who think it's everything that was wrong with his era. So he's got a lot of conflict.
I was thinking Vengeance and Varus was a split. Is a split amongst fans who are fans of just BBC One and those who are fans of Big Brother on BBC on Channel 4.
Right.
It's Vengeance on Varus is sort of Big Brother, the pilot, in many ways. Maybe a bit of extreme pilot, but I suppose it's also a version of Parting of the Ways as well.
I actually quite like the idea behind Vengeance and Varus. You have your political leaders as well. You know, you vote. When it comes to re-election night, if they lose, they die.
Yes.
Oh, and also, let's not forget, Vengeance and Varus has that one controversial scene where the Doctor accidentally pushes two blokes into an acid bath.
Yes, and then makes a James Bond quip about doing so as well.
Yeah. To be fair, you could sort of believe he'd do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if he gets any quips in Attack of the Cybermen the same way, but
He gets to do a bit of wordplay when Perry's got the gun at the beginning, and they apprehend two policemen that have been following Lytton around through with the direction as well. So he has to do some things. In many ways, I mean, Colin Baker was always my favourite Doctor Who. Mm. You know, when I was younger and I first saw Doctor Who on UK Gold, what was then UK Gold, it's absolutely gold nowadays, and doesn't show any Doctor Who. It's the earlier stories weren't that great, and then, you know, it got better later on. And it's always when a Doctor leaves or the series ends in some way, their stories get better. Because I used to be able to, as sad as it sounds, I used to be able to recite every single word from Revelation and the Daleks.
No shame in that. That was fantastic, really. So many good lines of dialogue.
Yeah,
brilliant characters, loads of double acts. It was just a really great show, and almost could have been without the Doctor. Not that you want him to be out, but it was just so strong on its own.
To be fair, he's barely in the first part.
Yeah.
It's always found interesting about that.
Yeah, the only real connection he has to the plot is when he has that attack by one of the experiments of Davros and finds out a little bit, but not nearly enough.
Interesting fact, a bit of trivia. Apparently, Laurence Olivier was originally offered that part of the creature he's battling, and they rolled down the hill together. Because apparently he'd expressed some interest in being in it, but they'd already got to casting, and the only role that wasn't cast was the mutant.
Yeah.
So they basically offered, you know, could you wait? And then they went on hiatus, and all that happened.
Yeah,
which is a shame.
Yeah, well, that close to getting Michael Goff back as the Celestial Toy Maker.
All right, okay.
Oh yeah, first episode of the next series after Revelation would have been Nightmare Fair. Michael Goff, you know, Alfred from the Batman films, he had to agree to replay the Celestial Toy Maker because he played them during the William Hartnell era.
Yeah,
I just find it interesting, you know, some of these actors, they stick to British TV, and yet some of them go off to these big careers in Hollywood and do all these different things, you know, Gene Marsh, Michael Goff. There was another actor, he's just recently passed away, but he was in Last of the Mohicans, and for the life of me I can't remember his name, so I do apologise, listeners.
Philip Madoc, I believe.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
If only because I was watching a documentary with him in it the other day. I didn't know that off the top of my head until I saw the documentary for a second time.
It's interesting what Doctor Who can do for people's careers. So we better wrap this up then. I think we touched on, you know, the basic plot, the notes of interest, and the controversial scenes. We're not going to talk about Colin Baker's costume. That's a whole other podcast for another day.
Yeah. Deserves it.
Yeah. I was going to try and drop in there. Just before we started recording this, I had the vain hope that my Twitter followers would be able to comment about Attack of the Cybermen. Sort of not necessarily shout out, but drop in their comments here, and I managed to get at least somebody to say something about Attack of the Cybermen, and my dear friend Benji Clifford, who is _Bonge on Twitter, he says that Attack of the Cybermen is a luxuriously cold dark and the Telos scenes are pretty impressive, atmospheric and cold, which I have to agree with him there. Yeah, shot on sand hills, there's obviously not much to shoot, but you can, you know, drop the saturation in the video and instantly looks very alien in those regards. And Benji's a big fan of music, especially by Malcolm Clark, who composed most of the Colin Baker era music. And that's what he loves the most is the music. And you know, personally, I agree. There's lots of great music in Colin's era that does drop back, even if it's the silly piano bits in Attack. that do get potted around everywhere else. It's quite nice here. I suppose to do something that isn't expected half of the time. I mean, when you compare that to gold, you know, you expect gold to just do mostly what he's always done, the same thing. But when you sort of go back to the 80s, the music is very, yes, it's very 80s, but it's also very clever at the same time in how it's used story-wise. Like I was saying earlier about playing music against dialogue, and you go up and down with the dialogue to force the viewer not necessarily understand, but to immerse themselves in that dialogue. And Attack is very much the same thing. There's lots of music in Attack. It was great. There's the Cybermen theme, if you like, that gets played throughout. Is quite well done. And obviously that some music scores that are used and translated in the rest of the stories as well. But sorry. So yes, that was what Benji said. Here you go. Can you say this somewhere? So there's me sort of shouting out for that one. So yeah, my only person who said anything. I think everybody else is asleep today or outside enjoying the sun.
It is a Sunday, so it's a day of rest.
Yes. So maybe this is probably better recorded in the middle of the week, or maybe I should have asked people a bit sooner. But
it's all right, don't worry. I was going to say, that's one of the things I miss about 80s era Doctor Who, especially with the Colin Baker and the Sylvester McCoy era. It felt like there was more effort to give each episode its own music, and yet with the current new series, since it's come back, it seems to be, we're just going to play the Man in the Blue Box over again, we're going to play the Ninth Doctor theme over again.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there.
It's like, you know, it's like with Russell T. Davis era, they have that opening panning shot of the Earth, and it's the same song, the and then just zooms quickly to Earth, and you're like, oh, Murray Gold, please do something different.
Yeah.
I might be wrong, but I think Murray Gold doesn't just work on Doctor Who, so perhaps that's how he tries to get around it, by reusing some of the stuff.
I think you're right, because there was something called Watts, and it sounded like Doctor Who background music. Those same sort of tunes, like Russell T. Davis era background music. That was it. It was Ashes to Ashes.
Oh, right.
The scene where the inspector meets Gene Hunt and his posse for the first time. It sounded very Doctor Who-ish to me.
Yeah.
But that's just me. So maybe people have got different... heard it differently, but to me it sounded like the same music.
Yeah.
But final grades then, like instead of grades, we'll just do recommendations. Would you recommend this to a fan that hasn't watched a lot of Doctor Who, or has watched a lot of Doctor Who? If they've never seen it before, I mean.
Right, for me, probably better if they've seen at least Resurrection of the Daleks and Earthshock. That would give them enough to go on. But I believe even when the show came out originally in 1985, a lot of the older references went over a lot of people's heads, and really, was it just for the fans, half of the show? So yeah, that's a big sort of flaw, especially for a show which opens up the season. So I'd say the latter, just they must have seen a bit of Doctor Who before, otherwise it'd be really alienating.
Right, David?
Personally, I have only seen Attack of the Cybermen twice, and the second time was me reminding myself of it today. The first time I saw it properly was about 10 years ago on UK Gold, and what I remember from it is probably the only things that I want to remember from it. So recommending it to other people, I probably wouldn't recommend it to anybody unless you're a diehard fan who just wants to see it to complete, having seen most of the episodes. Colin Baker, it's his only Cyberman story, and that's probably the only thing I'd say to watch, for people to watch it, for him to do that, is to face them. Otherwise, it's too much of a sequel of various other things to even suggest people to watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, story-wise, it's very 80s. Technically, it's very 80s. And because of its, not necessarily its 80s-ness, but the way it works story-wise, and obviously how many chefs were trying to make this program, it's very hard to think why someone... I think, if anything, I'd recommend people watch it for Perry, but that's just me.
This one, The Married Man.
Yes. Yes, you'll find lots of people like me who say exactly the same thing.
I'm sure a lot of dads would say the same thing as well.
Exactly.
Okay, me personally, I'm about to say pretty much echoes what you both said. This is like a fan episode. This is the type of episode aimed at someone who has read up on these or has actually watched the earlier, you know, Resurrection. Yes, they said what's Resurrection. Otherwise, they'll just go over the heads, like you said. I think that was one of the main criticisms from Remembrance. They kept referencing things. I mean, it's like you unless you've seen Three Doctors, you might not understand what the heck the Hang of Omega is. Yes, you can understand the Doctors left certain artifacts scattered throughout time, but at the same time, you wouldn't necessarily know who Omega is. But they do try to give that explanation, but
it might sort of make people think it's something to do with the Greek alphabet, or if I'm wrong. So that, you know, Omega is a very common term in some ways. Yeah. So. Not great.
I do like that scene though, where he goes to the funeral parlour and he's kept this weapon, this ancient time weapon that can devastate entire planets and reshape history. And it's just in the back room with some morgue.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's so Doctor Who.
Yeah, I do like that part of it, and I also like the scene with the blind priest as well. I did love that.
Yeah.
Because it is so, during his first incarnation, he did try to sort of socialise, because apparently his priest remembers him, and even comments, I could have sworn you sounded older.
Yeah.
But that's one of those...
I think Cybermen is what Remembrance is. Attack of the Cybermen needed to be more Remembrance of the Daleks. It was just...
Mm.
Again, too many people were trying to fix it.
Mm.
And it didn't end up being as rememberable as Remembrance of the Daleks became. It sort of lost out in that regard for being in the middle and trying to do too much of it.
I think Remembrance also more, not to make a pun, rememberable, like you said, because Andrew Cartmell got more control as well. So you see these little things that sort of become the staple of the Seventh Doctor, little body movements, little quirks he has, little things he just does that you remember him doing, like, you know, like the way he puts his finger on his lips, or the way he walks with his umbrella, like a walking skit. That's the thing I remember most of Sylvester McCoy that I love, that little umbrella walking stick of his, and the way he walks with it, and he uses it to point everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I think only one or two stories he used it to actually shelter from the rain, which is quite brilliant.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, didn't he use it to measure something once? I'm trying to remember what it was. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch that now.
He rarely ever uses it for anything else but rain, and in Remembrance of the Daleks are on the Dalek scout ship and he uses it to interact with the Dalek control panel. But otherwise he doesn't really use anything else.
Greatest show is Climax. Greatest Show in the Galaxy. There's a bit where he uses it, although he could have just as easily used something else. It's not like specific to the umbrella, but he uses it to lift something.
It was his hat, wasn't it?
Well, he uses pretty much this whole repertoire in Greatest Show. It's a bit of a manic episode all round.
Mm.
I think he uses it to balance his hat on, yeah. And then he turns it into a sword and a snake at some point in that same sequence.
Fair enough. Okay.
That's one that needs a DVD release ASAP.
Yeah, I keep thinking the only decent reason they don't release it, and they didn't release it on the old cassette until towards the end, is simply the title is so long, and it was just, oh, the practicalities, will this be seen on the spine easily?
I think it's getting released this year, because someone pointed out there's only, like, this year should see all the McCoy episodes out on DVD.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Because I know we just had the Ace box set.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm waiting for that to go down in price a bit before I buy it.
Right, yeah.
So I've never actually sat through all the Dragonfire.
Oh, right, yeah.
Then again, I also want to buy Paradise Towers as well, because I love Paradise Towers. It's just insanity incarnate.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a real soft spot for the cliffhanger of episode 3, except the very final shot. It's so sort of macabre, you know.
And plus you've got the cannibal grannies.
Yeah, that they scared me. I actually had nightmares over them.
I think I was only like 2 when that aired, so I don't really remember it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Hex was a very early gay agenda horror.
Right, yeah.
Because I'm thinking back at this, he was awfully camp, and a bit buff, which made me think maybe. Someone in the production crew somewhere has gone, maybe it's appropriate to put him in there, but I could be wrong. Maybe I'm looking at it the wrong way. I'm looking at it in RTD tinted glasses, I think.
I sort of looked at it as he was a coward trying to make up for his past mistakes. That was one of the subplots. And he's been alone so long, he's finding it hard to socialise. But then again, I've only watched that once, and again, it was on UK Gold.
Yeah.
Back when UK Gold was cool.
Yeah, when UK Gold was worth watching, yeah.
Yeah. Every Sunday morning. Ooh, Doctor Who!
Yeah, I remember getting up especially early to see the Blake 7 shows before Doctor Who, because I found that brilliant as well.
Oh well, right, we better wrap this up then, because it's 11 p.m. at night here in the UK. Right, I'd like to thank my two guests for joining me tonight, thanks again.
Cheers, yeah.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's alright, hopefully we can do this again one day, once I get stuff sorted. I'm going away for a few days, so my Facebook will be radio silence, I'm afraid.
Okay, make the most of your time.
Oh well, this episode probably won't get released till about July though.
Right, okay.
We've got something planned for June. I'm not too sure yet. We're still trying to sort out the details. Fortunately, I left it last minute again. It's one of my faults, unfortunately. But anyway, I'd like to thank our listeners for listening to us. I hope this encourages a few Doctor Who fans who listen to... excuse me, to actually pick up Attack of the Cybermen, or check it out at least. Yeah, once again, like I said, I thank Martin and David for joining me. Please check out their respective works, and hope to hear. Well, hope you all come back to listen again soon. Right, good night, folks.
Okay, cheers. Good night.
One day, I shall come back. And return I did, several times, in several different bodies, though many would try to prevent it. Not allowed, me, but I'm allowed everywhere. However, I always manage to find my way. I just reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, and invited many lovely people along the way to come with me.
Would you like a jelly, baby?
It's gone on like that for a very long time, and although I say it myself, my adventures have become a stuff of legends. People have asked me, why do I keep doing it? It's quite simple, really. I'm the Doctor. It's what I do.
Broken Sea Audio presents Doctor Who. Starring Mark Kurita as the Doctor. For more information, visit www.brokensea.com/Doctor Who.